The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This case involves crimes against children, and as such, will not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. On the 2nd of August, with the Scottish sun setting behind him in Aberdeen, just as he settled into his chair for the evening, Pasquale Righi's phone began to ring. As he picked up the phone, he already had a suspicion who it was going to be ringing him. He eyed the number, and as he expected, it was his ex-wife Teresa. Things had turned increasingly ugly in the preceding days for the once happy couple, and Pasquale knew that this would not be a happy phone call. Undeterred, he answered. The phone call was a mess. Teresa seemed overwhelmed, angry and upset. Pasquale was resolute in his position. He told Teresa in no uncertain terms her behaviour had crossed the line and that he was no longer willing to put up with it. When she asked him if he planned to take their children from her, he replied he no longer had any other option. She repeated the question multiple times, and each time he gave the same firm answer. As she regained her composure, Teresa replied, "Say goodbye then."
I'm Jess, and this is Skinwalker.
On September 30, 1989, a young and attractive Bakersfield, Californian-born violin player named Teresa Macrena Butimore became Teresa Righi, as she married an oil and gas engineer from Colorado, Pasquale Righi, in a Catholic service presided over by the local priest, Ralph Bellumini. Teresa was a relatively sheltered person and had never really held down a job of note since leaving West High School after graduating in 1982. Her inability to hold down a job was in some part due to having sustained an accident in her teens, which left her unable to seek laborious work, and had even left her functionally unable to practice her love for playing the violin and singing. Her private life was a small and relatively uneventful affair, with her only close connections being with Pasquale and her family. Her family was made up of Mother Patricia and her two sisters and two brothers, who were similar homebodies for the relatively small city of Bakersfield. Teresa was happy to play the dutiful housewife role, while Pasquale earned significant sums for his work in the oil and gas sector. To ensure they were always at the top of their earning potential, however, the family moved regularly to access the best opportunities available within Pasquale's company, Shell. In 1990, still in the honeymoon phase, they packed up their belongings, driving through Las Vegas and Utah to relocate to their new home in Pasquale's hometown, Denver, Colorado, over 1,000 miles away from Teresa's native Bakersfield, to enable Pasquale to take up a new posting The climate in summer was something Teresa was used to, but nothing had prepared the permatanned Californian for the brutal winter weather at that altitude. Perhaps it was with relief then that Teresa gave her consent to the pair's move to Lowestoft in England in the winter of 1997. How long that relief lasted when they realised that a balmy English summer only aimed at 25 degrees Celsius remained to be seen. Nonetheless, the pair were full of optimism over their life to come. Teresa had some quirks in her personality, being a little off the wall, as her American compatriots might say, but her relationship with Pasquale was always solid. They travelled the world together and had money to burn. They ate in nice restaurants and seemed to all who knew them to be decent, well-intentioned people living their best life. They often had large dinner parties for the other Shell expats based in Lowestoft, where Teresa would get out their finest tableware and linen. The table would be set a day in advance and a large bouquet of flowers would be set centre stage, mostly white roses or calla lilies. Some of the visitors drew some scorn on the level of detail being paid to a relatively informal meal, but any scorn turned to far happier noises when Teresa served her gourmet food, which could, in her humble opinion, have come from the kitchen at any top restaurant. One thing always bothered Teresa, however. No matter how often they tried, they were unable to conceive a child. The only thing their life was missing, she felt, was that they didn't have children to share it with. The reasons why they could not conceive weren't abundantly clear. Teresa had concerns about her own fertility as well as Pasquale's. They had money to burn and nature was not going to get in her way. In early 2001, Teresa booked into an IVF clinic and Pasquale came along. Teresa's eggs were fertilised, with some of the resulting embryos being cryogenically frozen and two others being implanted. Both took. Teresa was informed that the chances of having twins is relatively low in non-IVF pregnancies. However, in women of her age group, the chances are about 1 in 10 for those implanted with two or more embryos. However, the overwhelming enthusiasm was not infectious. Pasquale was excited about the prospect of children, but he had begun developing doubts over Teresa herself. The previous actions he had written down as her just being a little eccentric had turned into aloofness and rudeness. The relationship wasn't in the best of health. Pasquale's lack of enthusiasm around IVF was not that he didn't want kids, but in that he had been harbouring reservations about the long-term health of their relationship. Teresa had pressed on despite his objections, and when she announced to him that the treatment had been successful, he pushed his doubts to one side and shared in the joy of the moment. On December 17, 2001, the pair seemed to have put aside any differences as they painted the perfect picture of contentment as they cradled their two newborn, non-identical twin sons, Augustino and Gianluca. Their names paid homage to their Italian heritage, but their new English surrounds led to them being affectionately nicknamed Austin and Luke. Soon after the family returned home, Teresa's postnatal behaviour became particularly worrisome. She regularly refused visits from the state-mandated health visitor and had taken the crib for the boys into the master bedroom and demanded Pasquale sleep in another room so that she could pay more attention to them without the hassle of having him in the marital bed. From this point onwards, the pair shared very little intimacy and even less love. Pasquale was as present a father as his job permitted for his children, but the lack of intimacy and warmth between Teresa and him was plain to see. When it came time for the twins to move into a nursery room, Teresa installed a bed in there and slept watching the children at all times, while Pasquale was permitted to return to the master bedroom by himself. Despite it being apparent, the pair were on a one-track road to separation. Teresa once again attended an IVF clinic and had another of her frozen embryos implanted at the end of 2003. When she was told by her consultant the treatment had been successful, Pasquale prepared to try and fix the relationship. The family uprooted to the Netherlands for another opportunity within Shell, and on the 9th of August 2004, Cecilia Rigge was born in their new home country. Soon after her birth, Teresa began to complain about what she perceived as poor antenatal standards in the country, and pressured Pasquale to return to England. Their relationship at this time had improved significantly, and the twinkle-eyed baby had brought a level of cheer and certainty to the family which hadn't existed in some time. Seeing potential in their future, Pasquale relented, and the family returned to Lowestoft in July of 2005. Back in England, Teresa's mind turned once again to children. She sought out multiple IVF treatments, but none were successful. This caused significant strain in their relationship, with Teresa blaming Pasquale for the lack of success in the treatments. Pasquale was regularly treated to renditions of how his actions had stressed and upset her, and this in turn caused the IVF not to take. Pasquale, despite what Teresa may have said about him, was widely regarded as a kindly and well-spoken man. Whether he changed behind closed doors remained to be seen, but when rumours spread of the deteriorating relationship, most of those who knew the pair felt the blame fell more squarely at the feet of the eccentric and somewhat domineering Teresa, rather than the timid Pasquale. In October of 2006, the inevitable happened. Pasquale could no longer take the verbal berating he was receiving at the hands of Teresa and left the family home. He was still dedicated to his children, however, and quickly sought out the services of a lawyer to ensure he could arrange his divorce from Teresa, but retain access to his children and be present in their life. His request was complicated by the fact that after leaving, he had taken up a posting in Aberdeen for Shell, and he was due in the city in the following days. Taking advantage of the legal complexities and the physical distance between the pair, Teresa Rigge packed the children's things, vacated the house in Lowestoft, and headed back to the Netherlands. In February of 2007, legal pressure, and perhaps an underlying sense of guilt or affection towards Pasquale, meant that Teresa Rigge returned to the UK, taking residence in a nicely furnished home in Skene on the outskirts of Aberdeen, and allowing Pasquale some level of access to the children. Despite having done little to upset the boat, Teresa was deliberately difficult in her handling of Pasquale's access requests. She did not want him having unsupervised access, and she wanted to limit the number of days which he would be allowed access for. Her pleas were considered to have no basis, and Pasquale was offered fairly generous visitation terms and began to rekindle a bond with his three children. Pasquale and Teresa had extremely limited contact, although Teresa insisted on being there during Pasquale's visitation times. He had also tried to raise concerns over the fact the children were being homeschooled when he felt their social development would be better served at a local school of their joint choosing. Similarly, he expressed concerns over the fact that the children were all sleeping in the bed with Teresa nightly, something which had taken place in their youth in Lowestoft, but which he felt had now gone on for far too long now that the boys were 7 years of age. They were being sheltered in a way that Pasquale felt was dangerous and unfair to them. But his complaints fell on deaf ears. If Pasquale was looking to open communication channels, he simply had to find something on which Teresa did wish to engage. In 2009, Pasquale struck up a new relationship with a woman in Aberdeen, a fact which Teresa did not take kindly to and let him know in no uncertain terms. The previous reticence to communicate was swiftly overcome to inform Pasquale at length that he would never see his children again, then re-implemented to solidify the statement. Teresa Rigi, over the course of 2009, repeatedly defied court and social orders to allow Pasquale his right to access to the children. In early 2010, with further legal pressure eventually breaking down Teresa's resilience, the children were allowed to visit their father. To his bewilderment, each showed up wearing a geolocator beacon and a brand new mobile phone which had a speed dial function to enable them to phone Teresa for help, quote, should their father do anything which they don't like. Pasquale noticed a significant difference in the children too. He felt that Teresa's tight grip on their world had left them seeming frightened of him, and in truth, frightened of the world around them. They did not want to explore or even go out. They wanted to stay safe and cocooned in the small world around them, and in particular, be close to their mother. This fearful mental state of the children was later noted by a child psychologist as having been conditioned into them by Teresa. As 2010 continued, Pasquale was becoming increasingly concerned by the erratic behaviour of Teresa. She had always had an element of eccentricity, but the geolocator beacons, the ongoing worrisome tidbits he heard from his children, and his own keen perception, had alarm bells ringing. In spring of 2010, Pasquale Rigi informed his solicitor he wished to pursue further access and push for joint, or better, custody of his children, as he believed his ex-wife was no longer fit to be the primary caregiver to them. Teresa took the news particularly badly, and on the 12th of July 2010, she failed to report with the children to a court-decreed access date. Pasquale reported the children missing to Grampian police, and they began searching the wider Aberdeen area for Teresa and the children. When they were unsuccessful, they began to cast their net wider. Acting on a tip, Teresa and the children were traced to an address on Slateford Road in the southwest of Edinburgh on the 21st of July. The house was rented by a man who Teresa had met on an online dating site. Having performed a welfare check, the police who attended reported back that the children seemed safe and well, and Teresa seemed capable of looking after their needs. However, having been discovered, court officers attended later the same day to revoke the children's passports and serve notice to Teresa of the next court date. Teresa laughed when she took the papers and threw them over the banister adjoined to the stairs. When Cecilia asked about when their passports would be returned to them, Teresa replied before the court officers, stating, "When Mommy is dead." On the 31st of July, Teresa informed a man she spoke to in an internet chat room that he would hear of her story in the news. The man thought the statement seemed ominous, but he had little further to go on. Further alarm bells rang on the 2nd of August when Teresa's late night phone call was made to Pasquale regarding him pushing for sole custody of the children. When he had confirmed to Teresa multiple times that her behaviour had left him no choice but to push for sole custody, Teresa ended the phone call suddenly calm by stating, "Say goodbye then." The phrase had struck Pasquale as odd, but Teresa's actions had left him feeling that way pretty frequently in the last year, and he pushed it out of his mind. The following morning, anyone looking from the outside world in would have never believed the despair of the previous evening's phone call for Teresa Rigi. She had taken Austin, Luke and Cecilia to a cinema nearby to their Edinburgh boat hall and taken them to a local KFC restaurant for lunch afterwards, where other diners seen only three happy children closely attached to their mother at the head of the table. The children all loved the cinema and had especially loved Night at the Museum, which had led the twins to want to study dinosaurs when they grew up. The contented quad returned to the Slateford Road flat and to the safety of their shared bed. What Teresa failed to do on that date was attend a court-mandated appearance in Aberdeen. Pasquale, on the other hand, did attend. When the evidence was presented of Teresa's increasingly erratic behaviour and her overnight disappearing act to Edinburgh, the presiding judge issued a court order to remove the children from Teresa on that very day, as there was a plausible and substantial risk that she could cause harm to the children. The children were to be removed to the care of the social work department until further examination of the facts could take place. Despite this order, on the morning of the 4th, Teresa, Luke, Austin and Cecilia awoke as normal and continued on with their day. No social worker had attended Slateford Road the previous evening or on the following morning. As afternoon came, the noise from a loud explosion brought passers-by on Slateford Road to a standstill. Standing on a balcony 2 stories and 30 feet off the ground, Teresa Rigi stood looking petrified. Onlookers begged her not to jump. Their words fell on deaf ears as Teresa Rigi screamed loudly and then threw herself headfirst from the balcony. Her body should have made a sickening thump as it landed on the pavement below, had it not been for one of Teresa's neighbours, Jordan Cochran, who attempted to catch her as she fell. Jordan's efforts were largely in vain, as he did not fully stop her, but only managed to take some of the momentum from her rapid descent. Teresa's body still made a disturbing sound, impacting the ground. More onlookers stood by open-mouthed. Some tried to administer aid to the stricken women before them. 999, the emergency number in the United Kingdom, was dialed and ambulance, fire and police were called to deal with the explosion and the women lying dying, or possibly already dead, on the street below. The caretaker of the building had a sickening realisation. The explosion was inside the Slateford Road flat, and he knew that Teresa had 3 children. The children weren't accounted for. Realising he had little time to spare, he lifted his top up over his mouth and took off running into the building.
Hey friends, I'm Michael, host of the Murdermile UK True Crime Podcast. I would be delighted if you joined me every Thursday for a walk through the untold, unsolved and long-forgotten murders of London's West End, featuring hundreds of fascinating true crime tales you won't hear anywhere else. If you're looking for something different, the award-winning and highly acclaimed Murdermile UK True Crime Podcast is researched using the original police files. It's presented as a dramatisation Each episode is crafted as a labor of love, and it focuses on the victims' lives in an honest, detailed, and sympathetic way. Season 5 has just begun, so why not treat yourself to more than 150 episodes? If that sounds like your cup of tea, search for the Murder Mile UK True Crime Podcast. Thank you.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Pascual Righi was in his office when he heard disturbing news of an explosion in Edinburgh. When he noticed that the explosion was on Slateford Road, panic rose within him. His kids stayed there, as far as the bailiffs had let him know the previous week. Not wanting to cause an unnecessary scene if he was wrong, Pascual phoned his lawyer to ask if he could make inquiries about Teresa and the kids, just to make sure that everyone was okay without rocking the boat with the current custody issues. His lawyer promised to phone him back quickly to let him know what he could find out. A short while later, Pascual received a phone call back, telling him that it would be best if he left work and reported to a local police station. The facts which were relayed to Pascual Righi by Diane Smith, the family liaison officer when he attended, left him, quote, paralysed with grief. In Edinburgh, as the caretaker of the building had run into the smoke-filled flat, he seen three small bodies in the floor of the flat's main bedroom. When he checked their vital signs, he knew that Luke, Austin and Cecilia Righi were all dead. Even more disconcertingly, a type of funeral music was playing from a laptop within the room. As he left the flat sobbing inconsolably, emergency responders rushed into the property. The first officer on the scene was CID Officer Neil Stone. What he seen was not a typical scene for a gas explosion. For one, there were substantial pools of blood on the floor. Secondly, the three children were adjacent to one another, essentially in a row, albeit with a space in the middle as if they had been lined up. In his gut, he knew it was all wrong. When he visually inspected the bodies of the three small children before him, his stomach lurched. Years in CID could temper anyone's reaction to a body. But there were few officers who could see small children hurt without feeling the contents of their stomach head upwards. The children had visible stab wounds, as well as defensive injuries on their hands, which made it seem as though they had attempted to fend off their assailant. Their small, fragile bodies were no match for whoever it was who had attacked them. He steeled himself against the wishes of the contents of his stomach and set to work. This was no accidental explosion. This was a murder. And whoever killed these children was going to be brought to justice. Outside on the pavement, Teresa Rigi was being worked on by the first responders. She wasn't dead. Her injuries were severe, but the neighbour who had taken some of her momentum had likely saved her life. As they put her into the ambulance, she was barely conscious, with a severely fractured pelvis among other less severe injuries, including stab wounds. She was also now the prime suspect for a triple filicide murder case. As the blue lights and squealing sirens took Teresa Rigi to the emergency department of Edinburgh's Royal Infirmary, an urgent court order landed on the desk of Edinburgh's social work department. It was dated for the previous day, and an administrative error resulted in its late delivery. It gave orders for the department to remove the children of Teresa Rigi from her care at an address in Slateford Road, Edinburgh, as there was a significant risk that she may pose a danger to her own children. Teresa Rigi came to in the hospital to be informed that she was being charged with the murder of her three children. The only words she could utter were, "No, no, no." She was also charged with illegally tampering with the gas hob in the house by removing its fixing and valves, then attempting to ignite the gas to cover up her crimes. The medics then informed her of the extent of her own injuries. She had a badly broken pelvis, as well as a collapsed lung, a fracture in her leg and elbow, and various cuts around her body which would require management. Some of these were stab wounds, while others had come from the fall itself. Her stab wounds were clearly self-inflicted, and there was little doubt in the eyes of the investigators who had stabbed Luke Austin and Cecilia to death before the explosion. The real question in the mind of the investigators, though, was why. Teresa Rigi, from what they could glean, was eccentric, but everything indicated that she loved her children. Maybe even too much. Even speaking with Pasquale, he had told them he found her overbearing and overprotective, but he could never have fathomed that she would hurt the children as she adored them. As Teresa Rigi healed in hospital, preparations were made to evidence and then try the case. Seeking a confession from Teresa was one of the main strategies, and to facilitate this, and to simultaneously attempt to determine her state of mind, a psychological evaluation was undertaken. Teresa was intensely religious and had asked to speak with the hospital chaplain as well. It was from this avenue that Teresa had initially started to open up about what may or may not have happened in the Slateford Road address on August 4. She told the chaplain that she felt she had failed her children, as she had promised to be with them always. This perhaps began to explain the space in the row between Austin, Luke and Cecilia. There were, if one reads between the lines, supposed to have been four victims at Teresa's hand that day, one of which was herself. Why she was unable to kill herself inside the property was unknown, or whether she intended to kill herself inside at all was never established. She had multiple self-inflicted stab wounds, but none were fatal, and she would not have been able to light the gas she was leaking if she had ended her own life in the same fashion she had those of her children. The psychiatric evaluation period was able to glean significant details from Teresa. There was no smoking gun moment whereby she confessed to the entire situation, but over the course of her meetings, she told the psychiatrist interviewing her that she felt God had been calling her children home, and that she too was being called by God to kill herself, and that she wished to go to the afterlife to be with her children. She also accepted that she had been the one who had knifed her children to death, but refused to accept that she had pre-planned their deaths and had murdered them. The outcome of the report was that Teresa Rigge suffered from paranoid and narcissistic personality disorders and had been having a heightened episode on the day of August 4. Her belief that she was going to lose custody of her kids had been a significant aggravating factor for her condition, and she was, in the eyes of experts, not in full control of her actions or their ramifications. With this established, the initial plea hearing took place within the High Court in Edinburgh. QC Donald Finlay, the criminal fraternity of Scotland's go-to for the defence of the macabre, sensational and ludicrous, led Teresa Rigge's defence and spoke in her behalf. His initial submissions were that Teresa Rigge would not agree to a guilty plea for a charge of murder, but would accept and plead guilty to a charge of culpable homicide, with a partial defence provided of diminished responsibility through the aggravation of her personality disorders. The Crown accepted that this would be agreeable and proceeded on this basis, albeit with fact-finding to be done on the partial defence of diminished responsibility. Donald Finlay also submitted a not guilty plea on Teresa Rigge's behalf in respect of the gas tampering charge, which the Crown accepted, likely as a result of the difficulty in proving such a charge and it being of far lesser severity than the charge which Teresa Rigge had already submitted a guilty plea for. As guilt had already been established, the role of the remainder of the hearing was to determine, on the basis of the facts available, what level of responsibility should apply to Teresa Rigge. Donald Finlay QC made the point that his client, in his eyes, was not evil or a monster. She simply loved her children too much. When she believed that their father was going to take them away from her, she truly thought, according to Mr. Finlay at least, that they would be better off in the kingdom of God than living with their father. And, again, according to Mr. Finlay, anyone who could not see the tragedy that lacks in humanity. Whether one believes in God or not, it was not the opinion of the court that children are better off with him than with a parent who wishes to provide care, affection and love for them. And the presiding judge, Lord Kinclaven, made no assertions about Mr. Finlay's belief in humanity. Judge Lord Kinclaven did, however, accept that Donald Finlay had proven Teresa Rigge had a partial defence in law of diminished responsibility due to her personality disorders. But he tempered this by stating that she was still able to differentiate her actions and would still require a custodial sentence to reflect the severity of her crimes. In 2011, Teresa Rigge appeared for sentencing at the High Court in Glasgow before Lord Bracadale. She turned up to the court as though she were attending a job interview, wearing her finest white suit and with makeup expertly applied. In a galling moment for those within the court, she told all those who would listen that her children had picked this suit out for her to buy while they were alive. The narcissistic personality disorder, which governed her life, it was said, did not make Teresa Rigge easy to get along with. Lord Bracadale spoke at some length of the fact that Teresa Rigge did have a deep love for her children, albeit an abnormal one. He spoke of the fact that she had robbed three young children of their future and left a surviving family bereft. He also noted that Teresa Rigge was not mentally ill, but instead suffered from a personality disorder which held a different consideration in law. Lord Bracadale then went on to discuss what an appropriate sentence may look like and spoke of his own difficulty in finding an appropriate vantage from which he could punish this crime. Eventually, he stated that only a significant custodial sentence would suffice, sentencing Teresa Rigge to 18 years of imprisonment. He then applied a discount to the tariff, based on diminished responsibility of 2 years. Informing Teresa Rigi, she should expect a sentence of 16 years, backdated to the first date of her arrest. Then, in an interesting move, he also submitted a recommendation to deport Teresa Rigi back to America after she had served her sentence, as she had never fully taken up UK citizenship, despite meeting the requirements to have done so. Teresa Rigi was initially held at Caunton Vale, a female-only prison near Stirling in Scotland. Her time in Caunton Vale was not a happy one, and she had rarely ventured from her cell. She had taken to decorating her cell with Christian iconography and pictures of her children, which aggravated the other prisoners even more. Early into her sentence, Teresa Rigi ventured out her cell for the first time in weeks to remove a bag of rubbish to the general waste area. Kirsty Lee Davidson, then 20 years old, was in a cell across from the woman now known as the most hated woman on the wing. Kirsty Lee tore herself away from what she was doing and attacked Teresa before she had a chance to retreat to safety. Davidson landed multiple punches to the head and body of Teresa before three guards came and split the altercation up. Rigi stood up after the incident and told Davidson, "I know how you feel." This did little to deter Davidson though, who told prison officers and a local newspaper that should the opportunity arise again, the same outcome would arrive, because women who harm children would not be safe on her wing in Caunton Vale. Teresa Rigi was moved to a more secure area of the prison soon after, though worse was to come. On November 19, 2011, Teresa Rigi sat in her cell believing she was alone. She had her back to the door as Angela Hamilton, who was being held in Caunton Vale on an obstruction of justice charge, snuck into her cell. Hamilton grabbed Rigi by the hair and repeatedly struck at her face with a razor blade, making several deep slash marks on her. By the time guards arrived, Rigi was screaming and her face was a mask of blood, along with a clump of hair missing from her head. Hamilton denied responsibility, but a trial nearly 3 years later in September of 2014 took less than 1 hour to find her guilty of the attack. Given her deteriorating mental state and her status as a target for many of the women on the wing, Teresa Rigi was moved to Rampton Secure Hospital in Nottinghamshire, England in 2012. The publicly given reason was that there were no facilities for female high security psychiatric patients in Scotland at the time. But there were whispers that her safety could never be guaranteed in any prison close to the scene of her crimes. While in Rampton Hospital, Teresa Rigi developed an eating disorder. She made repeated attempts on her own life and was generally seen to be problematic to care for. Much of her mental state throughout the incidents and trial come from letters she penned while in Rampton. However, much of the validity is questioned due to her increasing paranoia during her stay. On March 10, 2014, Teresa Rigi was found dead in Rampton Secure Hospital. Initially, there was some suspicion of suicide. However, further investigation led to a finding of death by natural causes, likely brought about by the intense strain she had put her body under during her suicide attempts and eating disorders. Pasquale Rigi was left to pick up the pieces of a shattered life. In late 2010, alongside his family, he attended Aberdeen St Mary's Cathedral to pay his final respects to the three children he had fought so hard to remain in their lives. The murder of Austin, Luke and Cecilia by their own mother's hand had such a dramatic impact on everyone involved that even one of the senior investigating officers on the case, Keith Hardy, attended the funeral, something which is extremely uncommon for serving officers to do. Pasquale himself is often regarded as the forgotten man in the entire tragedy. He was not the killer, nor a direct victim. He was just a father who wanted to see his children, who was instead left to bury them and deal with the consequences of his former wife's actions for the remainder of his life. When speaking with the Herald newspaper in 2014, he stated, "The hardest moment, without a doubt, was when I first found out. Your life is all about your children. You have plans and you have dreams for them. In one instant, that's gone." If you or anyone you know has been affected by the issues spoken about in this episode and would like support, please contact Samaritans on 116 123 or reach out to your local crisis centre.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.